You're listening to Red Setter, your guide to digital cinema, filmmaking, and cutting-edge imaging.
Hi, and welcome to this week's Red Center, number 50.
50.
I'm joined by Jason Wingrove. How are you, Jason?
I'm well, Mike. How are you?
I'm extremely well, yes.
Thank you for joining me for the other 49. It's been a pleasure.
Actually, I should point out this was actually Jason's idea, so I'm just along for the ride, so thank you, Jason.
Thanks, mate. Appreciate it.
So this week on the show, we have a couple of interesting things coming up. We're going to have a discussion in the news, as always, and there are some interesting things that I've certainly been doing since we spoke last I want to talk about, to do with gyroscopes and Top Gear and things. And then, and by Top Gear, I mean the show, not the not camera accessories. And then you've got an interesting interview coming up later in the show with a war correspondent, somebody literally who has the most outrageous accounts of, and I say outrageous, I mean heroically brave accounts of photojournalism.
Yeah, Dan Fung Dennis, who has shot some utterly amazing footage following Echo Company, a company of Marines, into enemy territory and stayed with them, embedded with them for 2-3 weeks. So, and he crazily took along a sort of Steadicam.
We're going to put the pictures in the show notes, and for those of you that don't know, the show notes are actually like a proper sort of PDF color document with pictures and links and everything. It's probably quite good, and you can actually get it in your iTunes feed.
Yes, you can now. I saw that the other day. That's very, very good. Thank you, Mr. Montgomery,
for doing that,
excellent code monkeying.
And now, the Red Setter News.
I guess the first piece of news around the traps is the move from beta to release of Build 21.
Yeah, which is obviously, I don't think there's really much change from the beta to the release build, apart from the fact that it means obviously it's kind of safe, deemed safe to put it on your camera for production use and rental use. So, got a red, put it on, no real reason not to. There's not the major upgrade for Build 21 is, the addition of Red Code 42. Although me, as a director, I haven't really seen any difference between... we've been shooting a lot of the short film on Red Code 42, haven't we, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the biggest thing is the 42 for the 4.5K.
Yeah.
Because we've definitely been shooting 4.5K. And
we have.
And that is a big difference for me. I think that's a really substantial difference.
It is. It's a fairly niche mode for most people. I mean, how we've been using it is, for the majority of the short film we've been shooting, we've shot anamorphics. And for some of the pickup shots where we haven't had access to our regular anamorphic lenses or they haven't been available, we've had to switch to spherical lenses and obviously then still want to be able to shoot 2.35, proper, correct 2.35 for anamorphic widescreen with spherical lenses, which obviously the 4.5K mode has let us do rather than, I guess, what we had before, 2.2:1.
Yeah, and it's 4.5K. I mean, let's not, you know... It's 4.5.
Yeah, which is 0.5 bigger.
Well, yes, clearly.
Woohoo.
Yes, 12.5% wider, but that's not my point. My point is that it's... it is my point. My point is that it's actually wider than 4K. I mean, we always assumed that Red One was a 4K camera. At 4.5K, it's... I think the pictures look gorgeous.
Yeah, no, it really, really does. I've just been blown
it's
away.
It's astonishingly high resolution.
Yeah, I've been... I must say, the images on the film have been just fantastic, and we've fired it against hot backlight and flares and things, and it's just I'm never once have I looked at it and seen anything that looks anything other than film. I'm not being a Red fanboy about it. I just think it's
there are shots in the hallway of that girl walking along where the quality of light, the quality of her skin in that light, ungraded. I think it was Richard, the editor, who said just right there, that's a shot. You just frame that and stick it on the wall.
Yeah, that's true. It is really, really gorgeous. So
and a shout out to Tom, who was our DOP.
Tom Gleason. Thank you, Tom. They did an excellent job, and obviously. We'll talk a little bit more. We'll share a bit more with that as we go along, and we'll obviously be finishing in the next few weeks. And yeah, as that rolls out, we'll try and lead into that a little bit more.
So one other part of sort of Red News I wanted to tackle. It's a very little known and somewhat obscure thing, but we had some problems where we would get random frames that were corrupt on Red Rocket. So
yeah.
You run Red Rocket through, it'll be processing DPXs at like 30, 32 frames a second, but the odd frame would just be completely screwed. And by completely screwed, I mean it looked like somebody knocked a channel out. You know, it was that severe.
Well, top half of the frame was red and bottom half was blue or something.
Yeah, I mean, completely useless.
Yeah.
And we've actually traced that back with Red, and it took us a long time to being an earlier model of the Intel Mac tower that we're running on.
Really? Right.
We've upgraded to what's called the i7 tower. Problem's gone away. So that's a really interesting thing. And in fact, at some point, you know, we, I think, sent about 18 emails by this agent, and Red were working really hard with us. And I said, look, are we the only ones? Because, I mean, this is really, you know, sucky. And we tried a second Red Rocket card, and the same thing was happening.
It was freaking me out a bit when I was seeing it on the rushes. But you guys, pretty early on, even on the day or the next day, you guys knew it was Red Rocket and not the camera.
Yeah, no, we did. No, we totally knew it was. But when I asked Red, they were like, you and about two other people.
Right.
But I'm saying that now because you could easily be experiencing this problem and not know what it was and think it's some kind of dropout on the camera.
We might actually put a frame grab of one of those on the show notes, actually.
And it's an obscure problem with an earlier hardware build of the Apple boxes. So if you've got a situation, maybe you go to a post house and they're processing your frames and they say, oh, mate, you've got a dropout here, and you see a frame, just, you know, be aware that that may be that your footage is, in fact, in immaculate, pristine condition. And the Red Rocket card is coughing or sputtering with its relationship to the actual Apple hardware.
Now, so is the fix something that's going to come from Red?
No,
or the fix
is
you need to go to the Apple store.
Buy an i7 like we did.
Okay.
So then the problem goes away.
Oh, well,
and quite frankly, I don't know that with such a specialised thing as the Red Rocket, that it's such a bad thing to just say, look, you just can't run it on earlier towers.
Yeah.
I almost would prefer Red to do that than spend a huge amount of engineering trying to get it work on older Macs.
So like, can you be more specific about what the actual Mac Pro was? It was early, late 07, or what model was it?
You know what? I will get you that information.
Okay.
And because it's probably really important, I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
I'll get the exact point at which we think we move between an older Mac, and I'm talking like something that would be, say, 18 months to 2 years, 18 months old, and a new version, which I'm calling like the i7, and I believe the i8s are coming out soon as well,
okay.
The new Intel boxes. So, but I'm not talking about, you know, ridiculously stupid old, you know.
But you have to have quite a new Mac Pro then, really, because, I mean, you know, two-year-old Mac Pro is still absolutely awesome and kicks ass.
But a two-year Mac Pro in this case, I think, would be dangerous.
Right. Clearly, yeah. All right. Well, we'll put show notes, links to the show notes for what the exact Mac Pro we're having issues with, and I'll put a little screen grab in there of what to, so you just don't freak out next time you see that.
I must admit, I so love using Red Rocket Cine. It's just such a joy because I'm such a Red Alert fan that that program on steroids is effectively what Red Rocket is. And I know that it's going to be coming as a OEM kind of, you know, under the hood addition to things. Like, for example, we have Rocket Fuel, which is the offer from Assimilate, and we have our Scratch with a Red Rocket card in it now, and it runs really quick. I know all that, but nevertheless, I just really, really have always liked Red Alert, and so having Red Alert on Schwarzenegger level steroids is just unbelievably cool. I mean, it's so fast, so interactive, just zooming in and out in real time, scrolling around on the 4K frame. It's just, I don't really need 4K output right now because I don't have a lot of 4K playback, but boy, do I enjoy them.
And it's helped you getting the rushes out, because obviously what we've been doing is you've been converting the rushes to DNX HD for Richard to edit on Avid.
Yeah, we convert three paths. DNX HD is one of them. We also do a ProRes pass because we have a ProRes Lite or the ProRes HQ. Both of the paths are used. And then, of course, we also have just Red to DPX because your effects work is going to be, like its core-based is a DPX file. So once we leave Red World, that's our standard default output for the pipeline on your film.
Right.
And that's what we'll be doing with that. So, yeah, and look, in all cases, it works well. I mean, you could afford for it to be more multi-threaded on when it's making a QuickTime ProRes because that's obviously off the Red Rocket and back on the CPUs. But, yeah, no, it's great. I really like it. And I can't imagine not having it now. It's such a key, pivotal piece of technology moving forward.
Right, okay.
Now, cool. You said something about Sony doing something. Was that, somebody told me they've released a whole new format. Is that right today?
I'm just going to sort of look this up and get what it is. It's
why are you talking about NX? That?
Oh, no, you okay, you go ahead.
I was going to say, there's also a good video that's up on the 7D and how to set it up. Something actually we were going to be doing coming up as well, which is basically looking at how to set up your 7D. I think I might have touched on this before, that the idea of having your 7D set up with custom settings that are very neutral and effectively a low-con, for the old film people, it's a low-con pass of the footage as opposed to being a sort of a contrasty pass. It's the difference between having stuff baked in the camera that is very contrasty and would limit your ability to grade in post and not. Now, any trouble with that is that we had someone today at a meeting and they were saying, oh, that 7D footage that we had looked a bit flat. And I was like, well, yeah, because we deliberately shot it that way.
Yeah.
So it can make the rushes look a bit underwhelming.
Yeah, so Stu in ProLost has touched on setting up your 5D to sort of back off a lot of the factory stuff that the Canon, that the camera bakes into, essentially, the JPEG, the H.264 file. So Tyler Ginter, friend of Red Center, has posted a little, very simple video on his Vimeo page on how to set up your 7D similar. I'm sure the menu system is very similar, but it's obviously good to just see a moving version of that setup and that workflow of going through it and how to back off all the settings, including there's a couple of sort of major little steps in there that really help give you all the grading ability you can later on in post to make sure that your highlights aren't clipped and things like that. So that's we'll put links to the show notes to that. But if you go to Vimeo and search for how to set up your 7D, Tyler's video will be there, and that's definitely worth a look.
Did you suss out what this Sony video thing was?
Yeah, NX Cam. Well, theoretically it's prototype, but I believe it's about to be launched. NX Cam is, I guess, a new. We shouldn't actually be talking about it really, because AVC HD. Maybe I haven't had all that great an experience with anything that's AVC HD. To be honest, it's not in my book a brilliant format, but I guess it follows on from the Z5, I guess, the all-in-one fixed lens. This is essentially probably the kind of thing that's going to be competing with Scarlett cameras like this. This is obviously, it's all going to record to memory stick.
NX, as in Nfinelli?
Nfinelli X for X-ray,
right.
NX Cam.
And they're going to be NX Cam players and NX Cam, is it like SR? Like it's that serious, are they really going for a whole new format?
Well, that's the idea. And theoretically, it's going to go to, Sony just love doing this shit. And they're going to, it has essentially like dockable hard drive, or not hard drive, solid state flash drive modules, 128 gigabyte. Flash drive modules that are going to go on the site. Obviously, it's very early days. Literally, the Interbee exhibition in Japan is literally happening today and yesterday. So this is fairly fresh news. Yes, it's called the whatever NX Cam. Anyway, it's AVC HD. It's going to be reasonably compressed. And but look, Sony, they're bulletproof. They know what they're doing with this. There's all the audio and all the XLRs and phantom powers for audio, and it's all set up and got NDs, and it's set up to do exactly what you're doing. Just go out and be BC camera on Survivor, and that's what it's designed for. Anyway, yet another format from Sony.
So
it's been a slow week, folks.
No. Well, actually, it's funny you say that, because I had a terrific week, and it was, I don't think this is a children-friendly podcast. Fuck week.
No.
I had a great time. I went and checked out some stuff with the Australian Cinematographers Society, who, by the way, just a little nod, are probably going to be doing a lot more stuff with us here at Red Centre. And I did two things. Firstly, just off the dial call, is I went to have a look at this thing called a mini gyro mount. So now a mini gyro mount is something that Tyler, as in Tyler mounts on helicopters, and his wife came up to. Now, I don't know if this is true. I understood that Tyler's wife was actually Kubrick's Steadicam operator, but you said that's not right. But
well, theoretically, Kubrick used, I mean, it's particularly like The Shining, the classic sort of going through the snowy maze was Garrett Brown, who invented the Steadicam, and it was a very early days then, almost at prototypes that Garrett was running around with Steadicam for Kubrick. But hey, I could be wrong.
Well,
I could well be wrong.
It's
later on.
Is it Nelson or Nielsen Tyler? Nelson Tyler, is it? Anyway, and his wife, I think, is Liz. Anyway, they developed this. Forget the Kubrick thing because that's not important. What is important is this. Imagine something that is about the length of a red body without any lenses on it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so this thing has gyros in it, and I got to play with this thing, and oh my God, it is so much fun. So for those of you that don't know, the thing about a gyro is its purpose for being built as a camera rig is to provide a level of stability in the way a Steadicam does. You have a moving platform that you can move around, but you tend to lose high-frequency sort of bumps and jumps because when it's running up, and it does take for forever to run up, and I literally mean like...
You said 40 minutes, which I just find interminably strange to hear, but there you go.
But that's what it is. But this is a low power consumption gyro. But when it's running and it's not attached to the world in any way, shape or form, but for your two hands that are holding it...
If you happen to be in front of a computer, minigyromounts.com.au.
Yeah, but this is... Let's finish.
Well, just so people can, play along.
It's like you're trying to move something through water.
Yeah.
It physically is as if it's somehow skyhooked to something that you can't see. That means when you try to pan it or tilt it or move it, you are pushing against a force that's an invisible force. I swear to God.
Gyroscopics is a huge... I just utterly love gyros.
It's like any technology suitably advanced is indistinguishable from magic.
It is magic.
It is. It's magic. And I know about gyroscopes and...
we know about it. We've seen them forever. But essentially what this is a gyro-stabilized monopod. Essentially, isn't it, Mike? This is because it's not attached to the airframe of a helicopter. You can use this thing. You can chuck it in a bag and take it with you and hang out the side of a helicopter. And you don't have to have, FAA approved mounts.
It's not actually attached to the.
It's not physically attached to the airframe. It's not a part of the aircraft.
That would be bad.
No, absolutely, don't drop it. Maybe perhaps attach a strap, but out of the back of a car, back of a motorbike. It's very portable, very adaptable. So essentially, obviously what they have to do is have how my basic understanding of how gyroscopes work is obviously in the Tyler mount, you essentially have a couple of gyros. You have to have at least two, so they'd probably in here would be...
Do you mean this Tyler mount?
This Tyler mount, there'd be probably be a couple of gyros working in opposite directions. You have to have one gyro will sort of damp you sort of say on X and Y axis, like literally your tilt. So you then have to have another gyro at like 90 degrees, which will then damp you from say panning left to right, and one will do tilt up and down. So essentially you have to have them at 90 degrees to sort of stabilize you in both directions, I guess, because it'll only sort of fight you on one axis, which is a part of another weird sort of part of the magic of gyros for me. But it's in the old helicopter Tyler mounts, literally the massive things bolted into the side of the camera. We always ran with a couple of gyros mounted just anywhere you like. Mount them to the rod of the mount box rod or wherever you like.
There's a shock absorber arm for this as well. So
yes.
If you're in a...
It's like a shock absorbed monopod.
Yeah.
With gyro pack at the top of it,
but
basically.
You don't have to have the monopod. You can just hold the gyro thing
right.
And walk around with
it. Take the monopod off and then just literally hold it like essentially a base plate for the bottom of your camera, which then will park it or help park it in space.
It makes your camera quite large because it's like putting up
and heavy, no doubt. The whole idea of gyros is that there is a mass.
It's not like a stew... like the Stubling, Captain Stubling, like Red Rock Micro Rig. I mean, it looks
but
like
But in
that.
A way it is, because it has that sort of twin handles
like
there.
If you try moving it, it's the resistance of the gyroscopic forces, not the resistance of just inertia or weight.
Yeah.
It's not like just that it has a weight underneath it, which kind of makes it cool. It has a life of its own.
It's how you can...
I love it.
It's how you can stand up, let's say you don't fall over on a bicycle. take a bicycle wheel, take it off your bike, and then spin it and hold the axle on with both hands, and then try and physically steer or move it. There is
I know how it works, but I'm just saying, when you're holding
you get these really lovely, beautiful mathematics.
No, it's in pure maths, thank you. But as you've got this thing, as you're moving it around on the studio, it just produces this really smooth. Of course, you could do a Steadicam shot in a studio, but if you're in the back of a car, or my shot is you're in a helicopter, you get out of the helicopter, you get on the back of a motorbike, drive, get off the motorbike and into a car, out the other door of a car and through a house kind of thing, where places where Steadicams are all sort of bump rods and you wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah.
No, it's pretty heavy, but it'll take up to like 18 kilos as the weight of the camera that's on it.
Yeah, which is a fair amount. But as I say, the great thing is you don't have to have a technician to install. Obviously, if you're shooting out of, if you're traveling, if you're a sort of, you know, if you're doing the next version of Top Gear, you know, you're shooting out of the back of cars.
Now, it's funny you should mention Top Gear. Because anyway, that's the other thing that I went to a lecture
cool
about.
Thing.
I went to a lecture about the making of Top Gear, like from a DOP's point of view.
Which
and
Top
I
Gear?
I had a ball. Well, now, it was okay, so here's the thing. Top Gear UK has a Top Gear book, which is the book on how to make Top Gear.
This was the book that I desperately wanted to steal,
but couldn't. But the guys that had studied the book were there to talk about the comparisons between how Top Gear UK was done and how Top Gear Australia was done, which obviously read the book. Now, you're going to be terribly derogatory about Top Gear Australia, but you don't...
I think it's best that I don't even start talking about Top Gear Australia.
But I know that you are a huge Top Gear fan, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but...
UK Top Gear.
All right. But anyway, my point is that they have 8 DOPs versus the 2 that were on the Australian one.
Yes, it's very hard. You know, I'm sure it's an absolute struggle. And, you know, I've got this thing to sort of live up to and try and, you know, shoot towards, and you're not given the same facilities, not given the same budget.
And I should say to this, I'm not a huge Revhead fan. Like, I actually have a hybrid. I have a lot of respect for actually not buying a V8 and just burning fuel. It seems to me to be a, because there's one of the segments in this show that we were watching, how they made it, where the commentator says, while there is still oil in the ground, you should buy it for this V8 engine. And I was like, you idiot. But anyway, but having said that, it's boys and car toys when it comes to follow vehicles and tracking vehicles and stuff like that. And these guys have an Audi, because Audi sponsored the Australian one. They had an Audi all-road tracking vehicle because they had to be able to floor it to keep up with the sports cars that they were filming.
Yeah.
And there were so many interesting things about it. But one of the fascinating things that they picked out of... Because in the UK now, they're shooting it in HD, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but it used to be shot on
Digibeta.
Yeah. And so it was interlaced. And so they're using Magic Bullet to de-interlace it. And so that's what the Australian guys were doing as well before they went to HD, they'd shoot it all on Digi. Now, of course, in the Australian case, you're shooting 25 frames a second, so it's very conducive to a 24. But you shoot at 25, they would use Magic Bullet to de-interlace it, and then they would put stuff on. But they were clearly using ND grads and polarizers and a bunch of other stuff like that. But
yeah, doing as much as they can in camera as well to try and to make it look good, but you know, rather than just totally relying on post.
But there were some really interesting things I learned. I mean, one of them I thought was particularly interesting. The hero shots they always planned for not just Magic Hour, but the 40 minutes after sundown, because they found that gave the absolute... I mean, you'd know this because you've shot cars.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolute best sky to horizon car reflection point.
Yes, it's taken me a long time to remember that. And there's plenty of times I've shot car stuff and the sun goes down and you go, oh, well... Okay, pack it up, and then really, if you bother to push on and just work the exposure and go to the faster stock, that is just... I've shot stuff where we've had beautiful magic hour and nice streaks of lights and exactly what you would expect to be the really nice sort of car light. But it's when you just wait till the sun goes down and wait till it goes, and just, you know, the ambience in the sky goes up, and then the ambience all around reflected in the car goes down.
And the horizon line's strong.
Exactly. You get really good, you get really strong, it's almost essentially like driving your car into under a really big Shimira, you know, massive, big,
exactly,
huge Shimira over the roof.
So here are the two points that I found funny that I didn't know. Firstly, is they said that the tracking vehicle, the biggest problem, because somebody said, what's the biggest problem with the tracking vehicle, blah, blah, blah. And they were doing amazing work in terms of close work between where the Stig was driving and where the camera is. I mean, they literally, they did actually clip a Sony camera that managed to have the Stig punch the lens through the entire body of the Sony camera. So it completely became a shorter camera, really. But they generally were producing amazing stuff. But the biggest problem they had actually was the mud guards or the mud flaps on the tracking vehicle.
On the all road.
And they actually destroyed a Ferrari because they went on new roads in New Zealand, brand new roads, bitumen tarred, because it had that loose stuff on it, and it just spat up like a... And so at close firing range, it just worked like a shotgun and just trashed the front of the Ferrari.
The tracking vehicle was firing gravel at the Ferrari.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent.
So,
well, one of the issues with, particularly with Top Gear Australia, has been that the incredible bill at the end of their year of filming was something in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars for exactly repairs like this to stacked Porsches and gravel-rashed Ferraris, and which I'm sure the BBC's budget matters not. But
the
down
other one
here,
that I thought was interesting, of course, again, you'd, I'm sure, be... They said the number one thing that they had to work on to make it work, the number one consideration, was nothing to do with the actual cameras themselves. It was having impeccably good car-to-car communications. Because it's car-to-car communications that made everything. Everybody had to be able to hear what the driver was saying, and or the commentator who's sitting in the front seat. And then the... and the commentator had to hear one voice back from normally the DOP on the back of the vehicle, because the director in this particular scenario, no disrespect, sir.
Make it look too easy, don't they?
Yeah, and so you have the driver, the stunt driver on the tracking car, the stunt driver or the presenter or the Stig in the real car, but then you've got the guys hanging off the end. Imagine a welded on chassis that you can stand in, hanging off the back of the tracking vehicle, that has a over the top mounted off the roof racks jib arm that kind of comes out, and then the camera is in a vibration isolator, and that means the camera can swing left out to the side of the car or right out to the side. Now, of course, if you're going at high speed, when it swings outside the wind shadow of the car, it gets buffeted pretty badly, but at low speeds, it's okay. And then this huge mud flap guard thing that's basically stopping them from trashing the vehicle. And then two guys at the back operating and stuff. God knows how you pull focus. And and then inside the car with splits and with communications and stuff. But, I mean, you know, we talked, Jason, in one of your directing courses about the need for on set very clear communication, but
particularly with car-to-car stuff. Can be just nightmare, particularly if you've got you have to have almost one point of communication, and particularly in that situation, who could it be? Probably not necessarily a director, who's going to take the lead. You know, you've got a guy who's doing commentary, essentially is acting to camera as he's driving, and you've got a picture car driver, and he needs to communicate with the crane guy, so he doesn't swing the arm left when you're actually going round the right hand side of the car, and you sort of scratch the car. It's nuts. I don't know how they get away with it, but it's very, very hard. You have to have one point of control, and one car has to just do a nice constant speed and let the camera car be the one that creates the shot by sort of essentially doing the radical manoeuvres and making the other car look good by doing manoeuvres that the picture car is not doing, really.
Well, I just want to thank the Australian Cinematographer Society, because they organised all the stuff that I was lucky enough to go along to, and they're just a really great organisation. I've got to say, cinematographers as a group, I found to be just a really good, down-to-earth group of people to hang out. And I like to think that Australia actually
has some
of the best...
Everyone likes cinematographers, don't they?
We like cinematographers. Yeah. I think Australia has some of the finest cinematographers around, and I think that is in part due to a kind of a no-nonsense, don't-get-your-knickers-in-a-knot kind of approach. Because one thing that I will say, somebody actually said, so safety officers on this shoot? And they were like, well, common sense is your best safety officer. And I was thinking...
Oh, yeah. Until Mr. Insurance pops around.
I mean, honestly, the work that's done by the... I was lucky enough to visit the American Society of Cinematographers, and go to the clubhouse. This
Lovely.
Was a little while ago. And then we had a lovely dinner there thing, and then there was a screening afterwards. And again, the US guys just couldn't be nicer. And so, yeah, we really appreciate them getting behind this podcast and behind the work that we've been doing, and we hope to be able to do more with them in the future.
So with the mini gyro mount, do you know, I mean, you can buy it, or it's only for rental, or what's the deal?
That's a good question. They made seven of them initially, I think seven, some number like that, of which all seven were immediately bought. And so they're available for rental. If it's not seven, it's like 14, but it's some like really small number. And they're about $500 US, $600 a day, 3 or 4 day week kind of thing.
Okay.
And so it's a completely doable thing. But you know, unlike a Steadicam, I'm not saying I can be a cinematographer, but I could operate.
If you can operate a camera, if you can operate a camera, you can operate this. You sort of, but
because in a sense, it fights you to. And you were saying that your love is not so much those, because obviously you didn't get a chance to play with them, but you were going on about webcams and
well, we got started rummaging around, but I just loved, we talked about gyros, and I said, oh, I love gyroscopes, and we just talked about stabilised heads and camera mounts, and obviously the absolute killer rig that obviously Top Gear Australia and Top Gear UK would absolutely kill for is the Filmotechnic rig, which is probably like... is probably the pinnacle of anywhere in the world of the absolute best tracking vehicle rig. What the best thing about it is, they are apart. Obviously, you don't have to pre-rig these things. These, you know, essentially, apart from putting the camera on, the camera rig is all bolted and integrated into part of some seriously fast cars, usually mounted onto Mercedes ML63s or Porsche Cayennes, depending on what what they've got to chase. You know, if you've got to go out there on the racetrack and start sort of chasing around NASCARs, you need to sort of get the Porsche Cayenne. But essentially, you're going to have four people lugged around in style, and essentially you have a crane mounted off the roof, and the crane's all sort of servo-operated from within the car. It's utterly probably the safest way to go. If you've ever been on a tracking vehicle with crane and all that sort of stuff, it is an utterly dangerous, you know, exercise to, you know, essentially have grips hanging off the tailgate of a ute, swinging a weighted camera arm. The Filmotechnic, essentially, well, they call it the Russian arm because these things are actually built and designed and manufactured by some incredibly clever Ukrainians who've won multiple awards for these things. This is a three-way, and essentially they all come all bolted together with this stabilized head, and you can literally just chuck this ML over.
And the gyros at the end of the crane arm?
Yes, that's right. Well, the gyros are all within the... I guess essentially the gyros are probably sensing gyros. You're not relying on massive spinning weights. It would be just essentially sensing movement, and that would be counteracting with the motors in the head to counteract any movement, essentially like a webcam or a space cam.
Can I ask you a question about that? What is the difference between a webcam and a space cam? I should know that, but...
Well, I think, as far as I can understand, webcam was the original...
Yeah.
The original one. That came from Westinghouse. Westinghouse made, essentially, military technology to make this sort of, you know, submarine tracking and, you know, following submarines from a...
Well, and following cars in pursuits and stuff from helicopters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then that obviously got adapted to film, the film side of things. And I think the Westcam thing essentially got bought out and bought out and bought out and sort of essentially just got, you know, essentially nowadays they make, you know, a lot more sort of police and tactical and military, getting back to the military side of things. Spacecam is essentially started off as a competitor.
Oh, it's a different company.
It's a different company. And I think the main difference from what I understand with Spacecam initially was the way they mounted the camera and how their dome worked. A lot less internal reflections. You'll really know a Spacecam or a Westcam shot, more Westcam really, is that you'll see an awful lot of vibration if there's any lens flare, you'll see the lens flare absolutely flickering and chasing all over everything like a mad sort of madwoman's breakfast all over the shot, yet the frame is completely stabilized because the lens is, it's all happening within the lens.
So Space Cam is Ron Goodman, right?
Space Cam is Ron Goodman. It's essentially, obviously, a stable, any of those sort of a space, those stabilized camera orbs that you can put essentially everything into now. You can put a Red, I think, into Space Cam these days.
An F-23 in there.
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing that we have here in Australia at the moment, I think, is called the, if I get it right, let me think, it is the Cineflex, I think. It's a, it's essentially, it's a Sony 1500 CineAlta video camera. Essentially,
you're saying it's a dedicated one.
It's a dedicated, dedicated
but what they
camera.
Do, like on Superman Returns or something, which they know they use it on Superman Returns. Do they just bring it out, or
no? It stays here. There's one. There's one in Australia. Well, there's two or three, I think.
Because you'd
Australia.
Have this like on a Superman Technocrane, right?
I think if you're going on a Super Technocrane, then you'd be using another stabilized head, which is probably the most popular ones. If you're just literally throwing a crane around and you want to have quite big crane arms, but you don't need the whole aero sort of smooth ball to mm-hmm. be able to go 50 knots in the air, you just essentially want a stabilized crane head, then you'd be going with the Libra head probably, which is
right.
The most sort of often used. If you're going to strap it on anything, it's not dedicated, it's not bolted to a car, it's not a dedicated head, it's designed to just go on whatever crane you like, but it's again, it's gyro stabilized, and just it's like the Libra. If you Google Libra head, it's essentially the go-to head for cranes, and just smoothing out. So obviously for years and years, had to put up with really wobbly crane shots, and just getting your crane shot smooth was basically impossible. So nowadays you'd have Libra head is just absolutely outstanding. You're able to bolt that on four-wheel drives, on pitching ships, on ATVs, and just anything you can bolt the camera onto, you can get it stabilized, and it's just an outstanding piece of kit. And it could be all RF, totally wireless. That's
Dean Semler did We Were Soldiers, which, by the way, is one of my all-time favorites.
I've never seen that, actually.
Oh, really?
Mm.
It's got Mel Gibson in it, and I make no thing about Mel Gibson's personal views, but in this film, he's really good, and it's a really good film about Vietnam. And but the reason I say that is that on the demo reel on the website of Spacecam, they
right.
have the shot from that where the helicopters are going out, and Snake Shit, I think is his nickname, the helicopter pilot's leading the drop off for the guys going into the is it called the LZ? Is it the
yep landing zone?
Anyway, they're just going along in a line of helicopters, and then, like, the cavalry before them, they just suddenly, peel off one by one and just follow the leader, and they dip down into these valleys, and it's just the most amazing shot. I fear that something like that would actually be done with CG these days, but these were real helicopters, and
right.
it's on the reel. Looks awesome. Now,
yeah. Go to spacecam.com and have a look at the gallery, and in there is a couple of their demo reels, and it's just outstanding. Any killer aerial shot is just awesome. The other thing Ron Goodman does is that snakehead, which is it's a fixed wing, it's a twin prop fixed wing aircraft. But it just obviously to be able to go far faster than the helicopter can, and be chase plane anywhere where rotors don't work, and downwash of rotors is no good. Essentially, it's almost like a nose mount, but it's a totally pan and tiltable nose mount. With the camera is actually within the nose cone, and it's almost like a actually like that T-Rex lens that you've played with, which
yeah.
is essentially like
yeah.
an articulated
look back at itself kind of
exactly one of those exactly. It's like a reflex lens where essentially it's one of those in the nose mount, and I've actually seen that in a shooting star. I think I've seen it in the front of a jet aircraft as well. It's utterly.
But I was going to be all
awesome.
Clever. I was going to be all clever and segue from my Dean comment into the fact, and if you remember, he also shot Get Smart.
Yes.
Which was going to lead me to saying, and you had some issues with Get Smart over the 360-degree shutter.
Tons of issues.
Which was going to segue me into 2012, which Dean also just shot on
right.
the Panavision.
Right. I see a pattern forming here.
So you see a pattern, but you blew me by just coming up with some more interesting information
okay.
on the space cam. But
sorry.
let's take my segue anyway. Now I've exposed it. For
yeah, absolutely. Shutter
cheap trick that it was.
Shutter crime.
Shutter Crime.
Now, I haven't seen the 2012, but yes, 2012 has been causing a little bit of a stir, just, you know, I suppose, a stir, i.e. a few Twitters go backwards and forwards of people who notice this kind of things. And obviously, I'm sure that's us kind of notice it. But obviously, for all the other people that don't actually know what's going on, that imagery will actually feel like videotape to them and could probably take people who, you know, untechnical people, physically take you out of the film if all of a sudden it doesn't start to look like a film.
So what is it with this extraordinarily talented DOP, this extraordinarily good lighting director of photography, that he just doesn't mind on the Genesis flicking the switch to 360 degree shutter to get himself an extra stop? Because that's all he's buying. He's buying one extra stop. He did it in Get Smart. Yeah. I commented on that at the time. You've since seen Get Smart, right?
Yeah, you said it was like a couple of shots. Man, it's got to be 50, 60 shots.
I was being respectful
whole...
in the case that maybe there, Dean didn't know that he'd done it.
There's so much in there. It just kind of... It shouldn't annoy me. I actually quite like Get Smart. It's quite a fun film. But, it's definitely, there's a lot of really smeary shots which immediately look incredibly videotapey. And this is the Genesis. It should not let you do it. Well, if it does, big huge red flag should come out of the top of the camera and just, you know, like air horns
and
should
yet
go off.
Dean has done it again.
Yeah.
Dean's
done,
like, absolutely award winning cinematographer. I just feel really...
So what's the deal in 2012?
Stupid criticising this director of photography.
Well, but I suppose we could just all build a bridge and get over it. But clearly it's a big issue. I haven't seen 2012. You've seen it?
Yeah, I'm going to see it actually this Friday. But I've got to say, like, I find it really hard criticising someone whose work I've admired so much. I mean, Dancing with Wolves, the cinematography and the lighting on that
absolutely
is just magnificent. And he's done so much just... You'd have to say A grade. We Were Soldiers, magnificent film, really well shot. He's done just, I don't know, God, so many films. Apocalypto, which I think was one of the first times
that was
used,
one of the first Genesis.
But I mean, going
shows
right back to, you know, the Mad Max films and
absolutely
and stuff like that, which, you know,
or whatever it's called, Road Warrior.
Yeah, well, Mad Max 2 in this country, but obviously he worked with Mel Gibson for many, many years. But I've got to tell you that when I saw it on Get Smart, I was like, no, please. I don't know what to say other than if anyone knows Dean, if they could ask him very politely why he thinks that 360-degree shutter looks good. Because I got to say, for a man who's... I just cannot fault on lighting, I'm stumped as to why he does this.
Even if when you look at Get Smart, there's some utterly beautiful photography in there. It looks like...
Yeah.
When I see that film, I can really see the DP at work. I can see him saying... This location here, we need to be here at this time of day and having some power and some clout to get that production there. There's scenes there which could have been shot at any time of day, but it looks like they've had a well-oiled production to be able to shoot major scenes as sun is just setting. There's a whole quite complicated scenes which play out almost as the sun's setting, and then I can see after the sun's gone, he's gone in for close-ups and lit them, and it all matches brilliantly. It's just... And this is, you know, this is not a film where you really should be thinking about that. You know, it's not going to be a major award-winning. It's not.
No,
this is
me.
Not Dancing with Wolves 2. It's not what you expect, but it's fantastic even on a project like this to really go. I totally noticed the cinematography in this film.
Dean Sandler was the
very,
DOP
very,
on I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, and I agree that if you're doing
he's done some
Chuck and Larry, I don't really care too much what you do with the shutter. But if you're shooting, you know, something as major as I gotta say, if you're shooting the visual effects work, which obviously 2012 is, you know, disaster porn, I mean, do you want to try and make that look as realistic as possible? And so I just don't think it helps it to take it away from looking filmic by making it look video, which thus makes it look...
Jury's out till we see it, because I mean, obviously that could have been third, fourth, fifth unit, could have been all miniature unit, I don't know, and nothing to do with Dean.
I wish that would be the case. I wish somebody would phone us and tell us that Dean had nothing to do with that decision, was forced to do it by the studio under protest.
Well, look, I mean, obviously that shutter and the ability to swap to 360 is kept in the back pocket as being, we do have that extra stop.
Some people
if we
were
do
shattered by Andre Agassi taking ice. I was shattered by Dean Sandler shooting 360-degree shutters.
Mike, he's really taking it to heart.
Hey, we need to get out of our rat holes, which, by the way, this week have been awfully fun. And
next week will not be rat holes.
Next week will not be rat holes?
Next episode will not be rat holes.
Week?
I can't remember. It should be around November 30th.
We'll talk about that after the interview, because I want to get to this interview. I think it's an extraordinary thing when you get to talk, as you have, to these very, very, I don't know what other word to use, but brave cinematographers and photojournalists who just go into hardcore war zones without guns.
Now, what would be ideal to say would be to pause the podcast now, if you have the opportunity, to go to Vimeo or go to danfungdennis.com, D-A-N-F-U-N-G, Dennis with two N's, .com, and watch the trailer, essentially, which is what we're talking about and what led me to interview him, which is a small trailer called Battle for Hearts and Minds, which is a lot of the footage he shot with Echo Company, and it is seriously intense and right there. I mean, I'm not sure there's a lot of this around. I've seen a lot of war footage, but this is very, very filmic and very real and very gritty, and it's like the Mel Gibson film you're talking about, except this is freaking real. And this is, you know, he's running along behind troops with bullets over his head, and it is incredibly immersive and gritty, and obviously it's at the moment it's just this trailer, but he's evolving it, and hopefully we'll develop it into a finished project.
Well, Battle for Hearts and Minds is also a website of its.
Yes, website. So battleforheartsandminds.com is probably the easier link to give you. But probably if you have a chance, maybe just, it's only about 5 minutes or so, go watch that, come back and listen to the interview with Dan Fung.
I picked you specifically to be the company that goes the furthest south in the battalion's AO. Your measure is not found in how much time you have on this earth, but what you do with the time that you have. Echo Company is going to change history starting early tomorrow morning.
Well, Dan Fung, thanks for taking time to chat today. I really appreciate it.
Sure, thanks for having me.
So after getting kicked out of the back of a Chinook 18 kilometres behind enemy lines into fierce fighting, surrounded by Marines and rocket launchers and gunfire over your head, how do you find that presence of mind to not just simply find the nearest rock to crawl under, but shoot some truly amazing imagery like Battle for Hearts and Minds?
Yeah, there actually was very heavy fighting, and the first thing I am doing is looking for cover. So mud walls, ditches or berms, whenever there is any cover, I'm just sort of running as fast as I could. But once you do have some protection, I would simply focus on working the camera.
Right. I mean, obviously, you haven't just started doing this last week. You have a photojournalist background. So I guess even that doesn't prepare you for what you had to work with.
Yeah, I have been working in Iraq and Afghanistan since about 2006. And even before that, I was sort of training myself to work in intense environments and still be able to keep a very calm and collected state of mind when things are going down.
I might just step back a bit. How did you come to become a photojournalist and then also touch on this transition from stills to moving images?
Images from previous wars had an enormous impact on me, and I knew I wanted to shoot war. And I started by freelancing for the Associated Press in China, and I was covering breaking news there and really learned the nuts and bolts of the job. I went to Afghanistan first in 2006. And that was my first experience in a war zone. But technically, switching to video was quite seamless because I've been using the Canon 5D Mark II, and it's simply one button, and you're going from stills to shooting video. But I'm still learning about the complex layers of sound and motion, so still a lot to learn.
So how did you come to be embedded with Echo Company? What's the prerequisites that the Marines, I guess, would require that lets you follow them into enemy territory?
There's actually quite a lot of paperwork for a journalist to go with the military, but I knew about this particular offensive 6 months before it was going to begin. So I contacted the Marines well before it started, and I got a cryptic email many months later saying I need to be at Kandahar Airfield before midnight on a certain date, and I knew this was the start of the offensive. And so in the paperwork, I'd sort of listed my past experience with other military units, so they knew I wasn't going to slow them down or get in the way.
Well, tell me about the Battle for Hearts and Minds project, because obviously all I've seen so far is a truly amazing trailer, which just puts chills down my spine.
Thanks.
Just take us through the project itself.
Well, I was embedded with Echo Company as they were dropped deep into very controlled Taliban territory. And I'm following them through the fighting, but also very much through these situations where the Marines are trying to win the support of the local people. So a lot of it is these dialogues between Marines and Afghan villagers. And it's very difficult for a Marine to switch from this warrior state of mind to being a statesman or a diplomat. They're very much having to have these two contradictory roles to sort of give a view of what it's actually like to be on the ground, the fighting, but also the counterinsurgency.
Some very intense behavior and very full-on confrontations from the Marines and the locals.
It's difficult for a Marine because they can't tell the difference between a villager or an insurgent. Simply one has a gun and one doesn't. So they have to treat everyone as a potential enemy, but also as a potential ally. And it's a very frustrating task for them.
So do you like head into battle with a given client and a given delivery in mind, or is it essentially like stock footage that you would then on sell to AAP, etc.?
I go in with stills assignments. So I'm shooting for a certain publication, but all this video work is done for myself. So I own all the rights. I'm going to be assembling this into a sort of full-length documentary. And where it's going to actually end up, I'm not quite sure yet, but I'm in talks with a number of different potential broadcasters or producers.
I haven't seen footage like this captured before, really. It is literally
buried
in mud, you know, gritty, immersive, scary.
Yeah, I mean, I am trying to bridge this disconnect between what's happening on the ground and the public consciousness. I think after 8 years, there's been a bit of a numbing to these wars, these car bombings and the deaths. It's something that's so regular that it doesn't mean much anymore. So instead of trying to convey the facts of the war, I'm trying to convey the emotion. What does it actually feel like to be on the ground? What does it feel like to be either a Marine raiding a house, or what does it feel like for a villager to have your house raided?
By sheer fact of being right behind the guys and right in the thick of it, you've no doubt seen a lot of things in combat that you just can't unsee. I mean, you're a journalist and not a trained soldier. How do you deal with that side of the job and switch that off, if at all ever possible to do so?
Yeah, there are some certainly tough situations and close calls that have affected me. There is a close community of journalists that have also covered war, and I think it's important to talk to them and share your experiences. And so there is a support network out there, but there is certainly tough things that you go through.
Okay, well, I'll touch on the gear side. If you'd told me before you went into a war zone the rig that you were going to take, I would have said you were ready for a Section 8, but take us through that whole rig and the gear that you took with you.
Yeah, the Canon 5D Mark II is a stills camera. It wasn't initially designed for video, so there were some serious limitations. But as a stills photographer, it was the first camera that I could really apply my same aesthetics to video. And it was pretty seamless to be able to hit one button and be shooting video. But since there were such serious limitations, certainly with the audio and the stabilizer, I had to build a custom rig to actually have it be able to work in a war zone.
Yeah, well, take us through that rig, because it reminds me of Aliens, the Steadicam-mounted gun. It's the craziest rig.
Yeah, my friend Riley calls it the improvised video device, because the camera body is sitting on a Glidecam 2000 HD. That provides the stabilization. Then that is attached to a very custom body pod strap system that attaches to my body armor. And when I was not shooting, I could rest it because it actually was quite heavy once it was all put together. Anytime I wanted to shoot, I would unsheath it and have it handheld and really depend on my arm to absorb a lot of the movement. But once I could get it, it took about 2 months to get my arm strong enough and to learn how to really move. But once I could get it right, I could be running, they could be running, and I could still get some very smooth, steady shots. For the audio, there's no way to sort of mount professional mics onto it the way I need to do it, so I built a custom aluminum wing that is basically an aluminum plate that sits out from the Steadicam. And on either side, on one side I had a ME66 Sennheiser shotgun mic, and then on the other side I had a beach box that we could take in the XLR mics. Then on the top of the camera, I had a Sennheiser G2 receiver for my wireless. I usually put the wireless mic on the sergeant that was yelling the most.
Right.
So those would go into two channels and into the peach box, which would convert it to a mini jack that would go straight into the body.
So how do you get around the 5D Mark II's automatic gain controls?
Yeah, that was certainly a limitation because in the camera, there's auto gain control. So no matter what you do outside, it's going to be changing it. That was just something that I had to work with. There were some limitations, but now there is a magic lantern hack that allows you to turn off the auto gain control.
The recent firmware update that lets you have manual exposure and has been a godsend. Were you shooting before that update?
I was shooting in Afghanistan before there was the manual firmware that allowed manual controls. And it was extremely frustrating to try to lock exposure with my hand covering the lens and then taking my hand away, locking it again to trick it. But once that firmware came out, I could just set my settings to about 1/60th of a second for my shutter speed and f/2.8 for my aperture. And then I used a variable ND filter to allow me to cut the light from between 2 and 8 stops. And that was essential, especially working in bright daylight conditions.
What you've brilliantly done is nailed the film look fantastically. Obviously, as you say, you're using the Singray Vari ND filter, I guess,
yeah,
to control depth of field, because a lot of the footage looks incredibly shallow depth. It looks beautiful.
That's one of the advantages of the 5D Mark II, is you can use really nice lenses and get down to this extremely shallow depth of field. The problem was that if your subject moved at all, you would lose focus. So I had to keep either the same distance from whoever I was shooting or constantly be racking focus. So on my mind much of the time was, is it sharp? Am I getting focus? And on that little back screen, it was, the resolution's good enough to actually see if you're on or not, but it wasn't ideal.
So are you having like a loop finder as well? Because that the screen's fine, but in bright sun, it's crazy, particularly trying to pick focus on HD.
Yeah, I would use a loop at night to cut down on my light emissions, because any sort of light would attract attention. But to have a camera in front of my eye while I was running and trying to maintain awareness of what was going around me wasn't useful. So I ended up just using the back of the screen, even in bright daylight. So it was pretty hard to see.
Obviously, you're really kind of strapped in there with this rig. How do you sort of change the different shooting modes, I guess, from wide run and gun, sprinting, full steady cam mode, to then shooting closer kind of portrait mode, and then obviously switching to stills as well?
I found that I had to actually be in either the mindset for shooting stills or be in the mindset for shooting video. If I was shooting stills, I'd take the camera off the rig and shoot the way I traditionally did. If I was shooting video, I'd put it back on the rig. And I'd bring a number of lenses with me. But I found that in these situations, there's just no time to actually be fumbling around and changing lenses. So I stuck with one versatile lens, the 24-70 f/2.8. That gave me the option of going wide or getting it a bit tighter and still be able to get down to f/2.8. And even with the prime lenses, which I love for stills, going down to f/2.0, it just wasn't that useful because it was so hard to get my subject locked on with focus.
Yeah, I guess you would start the day with your stills hat on and just shoot stills that day.
It was either one or the other. And I think there are people that are trying to do both, but you're going to get mediocre results. You really have to choose one or the other and decide which way you're going to work.
You have the benefit of a bit of war zone experience before this, but obviously this is the first time you've gone into it with a Steadicam strapped to your waist.
Yeah. I mean, I did practice a bit before, and I would get some really strange looks back here in London. But you do have to practice with it. And before actually starting going to Afghanistan the first time in 2006, I'd put myself in situations, whether they be riots or protests, that would test my ability to be able to work under very intense environments.
The movie mode of the 5D does have its limitations, particularly the rolling shutter, aliasing and stuff. What bugs you? What bugs you the most?
There are a lot of things that bug me. I guess one of the most frustrating things was that overheating. It was 45 degrees out there, so hot that more Marines were dropping from heat exhaustion than from getting shot. So, the camera, there's a little red icon that comes up once it starts to overheat, and then shortly after that the camera just turns off. So there would be situations where I'd simply, the camera would be off and I couldn't shoot anything. I didn't have a second body, and that was extremely frustrating.
So how do you get out of that? I mean, it's not like you're carrying around kilos of ice packs with you. You just have to just switch it off and wait, I guess.
You just wait, yeah.
Right. Well, I'll touch on the heat exhaustion thing. Obviously, you're traveling just like any other Marine. You need everything on your belt or your back for not only just shooting, but sleeping and eating, I guess. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's everything you need, you have to be able to carry. And much of that is, that weight is going to be your body armor. And then food and water is also a huge amount of weight. So I ended up bringing 6 extra batteries, about 6 other CF, 16 gigabyte CF cards, and an extra pair of socks, and then a lot of water. So there wasn't, and then a MacBook Pro with an external 500 gig hard drive to download the footage at the end of each day. But there was a whole lot of other gear that I would left behind because it was just too much to take.
What is your in-field backup strategy, and like where you're editing as you go along, or uploading footage as you go along, or stills?
Yeah, at the end of each day, I would dump everything onto a MacBook Pro. And the idea I thought would, I could sort of edit in the field, but in actuality, I was far too exhausted to do anything besides sort of shooting and going out on these missions. And if I'd done it again, I would have brought just double backups of everything, because I was very close to losing all my footage. So I would recommend having 2 hard drives and just having 2 copies of everything that you shoot.
At the end of the day in a war zone, you don't just all go back to the hotel. How do you manage power, recharging? I mean, obviously, you're just sleeping in the dirt, are you?
Yeah, I'm just sleeping in whatever we can find. So the first few nights was in a mud hut, and the Marines were so nervous about the situation that they posted a guard at the door, kneeling with his gun raised, just in case someone came in the night, and they would take turns. There isn't much time to go through your footage, or you simply shoot, download it, and turn it all off to save power. We were told we wouldn't have any access to power for about the first week or so. So I was being very careful about what I was shooting and what I was using my batteries for.
So you just power up the Mac just long enough to back stuff up and then shut it down and just pray.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Wow. Is the concept of press photographer as just a photographer an outdated one?
Yeah, I think journalism is changing very quickly right now. And if you're a stills photographer and you're not shooting video, you're going to be left behind. We're moving towards mediums where we're not just limited to stills. Most everything is moving towards the web and multimedia and video. So it's with increased bandwidths, we can actually start streaming HD video. So I think it's important to really be multi-skilled and not only be able to shoot stills and video, but to shoot for a variety of different situations and different kinds of jobs.
So the idea of a stills-only assignment is drifting off into the sunset?
They're still out there, of course, but especially for freelancers, the market is getting really difficult. And simply waiting around for that 2-week stills assignment, it's not going to really happen anymore. You really have to be proactive and shoot stories and try to sell them on your own. And there really isn't a model right now. It's really up in the air. So I think it's a good time to experiment. Go out there, shoot something video, shoot some stills, combine it, and get out on the web. And I really think it's important to, for journalism especially, to start looking at ideas of how to monetize online video and start creating online networks that are specialized in certain fields and be able to create communities around them that are all interested on the same topics.
Do the Marines treat you like someone in the way or a threat to their safety, or how do they take to journalists embedded with them?
Usually there's an initial checking out period where they look you over. They're not quite sure who this outsider is to these very tightly knit units. But after you show that you can keep up, you stay out of the way, and you're not there to show them in the wrong light, trust builds very quickly because you're going through the same difficult situations and you actually get to know them really well. You're going through some really difficult situations and they trust you and you trust them.
So do you think that they react differently to the camera? Do you think that they put the game face on a bit?
Well, I try to spend enough time with a military unit so they actually forget I'm there. That can take a couple of weeks. But they're also, they have a lot of other things to worry about. And there is a point where they're not worried about the camera next to them. They're worried about the bullets going overhead.
Which I guess leads me to the footage again and what you're doing with it. Can you tell us at all what the sort of format might take?
Yeah, I want to sort of have a hybrid distribution model. So approach the traditional means of distribution, but also really look into online, because I think that is the future. That is, the web is how we're going to receive all our content and information. So there, possibly theatrical, possibly for TV, but I really want to focus on the web. I mean, my goal is to reach the widest possible audience. I am a photojournalist, so yeah. It's less about winning awards than reaching and engaging an audience that are ultimately responsible for this war.
I've got to say, from my point of view, this isn't a pro-military or pro-war or whatever kind of statement. I'm just saying that it's incredibly important in any society that there be the ability to see what's going on for the sake of the soldiers on the ground as much as the sake of the society that's sending them to war.
Yeah.
The role of the war correspondent, the role of the war journalist, to the documentarian, to give us these things is absolutely invaluable to a society's understanding what the hell's going on. Now, whether you agree or disagree with any of the conflicts that are involved, it doesn't matter. Like, you want to be able to see what's going on and know what's going on. And
yeah. And
people that are on the ground, I'm sure, would totally wholeheartedly want people to know what's going on and be aware of it. I think the worst thing would be to think that you were sort of not in the consciousness of the people that were back home enjoying whatever, comforts that necessitates all.
And it's this kind of third-party or independent projects like this that give you that really the truth about it. You know, I mean, obviously anything that's come from a non-independent, like Fox or whatever, you're never really going to get the real story from news clips and news snippets. This is the unedited, unexpurgated, undiluted reality that's out there. And it's
You touch on it
great that someone brings it back.
Quite literally, he went in with Echo Company, 2nd Battalion, 8th Marine Corps, 18, and you said that at the very beginning, 18 Ks, but literally was 18 Ks behind, and there was like 3 days of fighting. This is not sort of like just going out with them on a patrol from the green zone.
Yeah, no, he's very, not shy about it, but he's very, very sort of self-contained about it, which I'm sure you would, having gone through it. You can't go in and be embedded with these guys without...
Generally speaking, and I speak only as the son of, my father was in the military, people that have been through serious stuff don't talk about it.
Yeah.
They just don't. Does your family got a military background at all?
No, not at all.
You probably know people that, talk the talk and carry on and stuff. But then people that have really seen stuff.
Mm.
You may not find out for years that they've seen really serious stuff, and then they are the ones that don't talk about it. They either don't think they can or choose not to.
Mm. Well, not that I really wanted Dan Fung to really go in depth with it, but it was interesting to.
I can understand that he would be kind of reserved. He wouldn't be all gung ho and carrying on, as he isn't, because that's what I typically have experienced myself from people that have been through something really serious like that. Now, he was shooting on the 5D Mark II, right?
Yeah, 5D Mark II, and he actually started before the... I'm not sure if we touched on the interview, but I think he started before the firmware update, so he spent the first week or two trying to do that manual hack for exposure, and then eventually got the manual exposure, and then obviously it's now working on the jailbroken mode with the what is it called? I'm trying.
I know what you mean, the version of the firmware that was
that thing
gave you the levels and stuff.
Yeah,
and a bit of an ad for the GlideCam 2000.
It's pretty impressive. I mean, obviously this is the thing has weights on it. He's crazy. Any kind of Steadicam, obviously it has to have weights at the bottom to balance the camera at the top. You're carrying weight into a war zone. I think it's fantastic.
Well, but look, when you look at it,
yeah, I mean, as we've discussed with the 5D, you've got to have some kind of stabilizing, some way of carrying it. So it was kind of clever thing. He could essentially carry it as a Steadicam, or then, you know, rest it on his knee as a monopod, or, you know, just unclip it and just go handheld mode. So
it'll come as no surprise that he actually has our Twitter tag of the week. We sort of name somebody on Twitter that we think is really interesting in this area of digital cinematography, and that's Dan Fung. So it's actually, you know, twitter.com/danfung if you want to follow and see what he's up to. And he twitters when he's able to,
yeah,
a reasonable amount, if that makes sense.
Yeah, he is. I think he's back home, but he will be shortly heading back into. Getting back in when Echo Company goes back in, obviously.
Well, as we record this, he's just posted that he's following up with Echo Company in Jacksonville.
Right. Okay. Now, so cool. Yeah. So he will be heading back to them. Obviously, he'll get some more footage, and we'll sort of the Battle for Hearts and Minds as a project will evolve a bit more, and hopefully, we'll get to see something a bit more longer.
If you look at his Twitter feed, there's a link to that website on the side there.
Terrific. Well, look, again, thank you, Dan Fung, for taking the time. Really appreciate it, man.
Yeah. No. Totally. So. So that brings us to the end of this ep. As you said jokingly before, next time we tend to try and come out every 2 weeks with Red Center, and sometimes we come out every week. As we record this, in terms of timescales, we've got about, I think, 9 days until the 30th of November announcement, which, as the 30th of October announcement covered Epic, this will be covering the Scarlett camera.
Yeah.
And so we want to be able to report that and, again, try and give you some really incisive coverage as to what's going on there. So we'll try and hook up to see if we can twist some arms and get one of our friends at Red to talk to us. I think the Scarlett discussion will be different from the Epic discussion, because there's no doubt about it, the Scarlett camera is aimed at a broader audience.
Yeah.
Any sort of guesses as to what you think might be coming?
You bastards.
I'm a bastard. Yes, there's
that. I've no idea.
Yes.
No, I'm.
Other than that.
No. What am I hoping for? I'm hoping for maybe slightly upped specs on the fixed lens Scarlett. A little bit more info.
$2,500 one.
No, I think it's going to be, well, the 3K for 3K.
Well, no, but you missed my Twitter post that Ted actually discussed on camera on somebody else's.
Oh, right.
$2,500.
Yes, that's true. I did hear that. I did read that.
I'm not leaking.
No, that's true. I did hear that.
I got an email from one of the senior people at Red, not Ted, I should point out, but someone very senior at Red, who told me that I'd been thrown off the tattoo list for picking on Ted in our last interview. He goes, sent me that yesterday. I was like, great, thanks, man.
Picking on somebody recovering from heart surgery.
Yes.
Yeah. No, look, I'm not gonna prophesize on what's happening. I don't know. It's all be good. It'd be great, at least, if there was some sort of release date, some pricing.
I think it'll have a little red flag that pops up and shakes whenever you go into 360 degree shutter, as per your idea. I think they're going to incorporate that.
Just a little air horn or a buzzer or something. Actually, maybe, you know, like those little timed grenade things like you pass around at parties that sort of give you an electric shock.
Okay, the camera will become electrically unsafe.
Yeah,
in 360 degree shutter mode.
Soccer mums will be dropping them by the sidelines.
This camera doesn't work. Well, you don't really understand cinematography. I recommend you
just lock you out. Lock you out for exactly. Lock you out for half an hour.
You don't deserve to have a camera like this.
You will not.
Sod off.
Sorry, you've exceeded.
You've exceeded the taste limits that we prescribed.
You've committed shutter crime.
Shutter crime.
So anyway, I'm hoping that we'll see. I guess, obviously, what was announced with Epic was that there was, at least going forward, people who were previous Red One owners, they knew what to do, and there was a path going forward. What will be great is with Scarlett is that there is some form of information about how we order, how can we get our hands on one, what's the, you know, for non-Red One owners, because obviously there's going to be a lot more of those wanting Scarlets than there are Epic people wanting.
I think you've actually just touched on a really interesting point, which is Epic has always been discussed in terms of a lineage. You know, you have a Red One, you'll go to an Epic, there'll be an upgrade path, whether or not you could trade in, blah, blah. Scarlet's like blank piece of paper. I mean, I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that, God, I hope I publicly said this. Jim said publicly that Scarlett would be available first to Red One users. Did he say
yes,
that publicly?
I'm sure, absolutely, because you know
my mouth off here, but
yeah, because I'm on your list, right?
You're on my list. Yes,
the 18 or 19 other people.
You are 6 on my list.
Absolutely.
The three founders of the company, 1, 2, and 3. Our, yes, business director is 4. My wife is 5. You're 6.
Is your wife a soccer mom?
Well, netball mum, but yeah. We need 2 in our family for stereo. But anyway, yeah, look, whatever. But the point is, yes, the system is quite unusual. And, you know, whereas I think there'll be few of us who are putting our hands up for 4 or 5 Epics, I mean, it's completely conceivable that somebody would want, you know, 3 Scarlets. I mean,
the trick with Scarlet, I think, is going to be is that it needs to be, when you look at it and how it is now integrated in all the accessories with the Epic, it's a lot more sort of part of the Epic family, I suppose, than the original idea of this sort of pocket camera, you know, all-in-one pocket camera. It's become a little bit more integrated, but you've got different mounts and all the accessories will work with it. That sort of feels at odds to me with what would need to happen, which is this sort of more mass-produced, you know, almost like HVX 200 kind of numbers that we're talking, that people are going to be, the kind of people, numbers of people that are going to be interested in buying it, is going to way outstrip, you know, the kind of the numbers that we're going to initially see for possibly the first year. I mean, I'm sure Red's thought of this, but, you know, it...
I just keep saying it, Red has a good pedigree in consumer delivery en masse like no other company has. This is not a company that's learning how to accommodate volume.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, in one sense.
Absolutely.
But it has a lot
of
people that know that stuff.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. But anyway, I think that there's... What they think of the numbers are going to be... I think they're going to be surprised by the numbers. I'm sure they've worked out some numbers in their heads.
It's hard to say, though, because, like, you know, I thought that universally, I really expected that there'd be just screams of delight over Smoke on Mac, which was announced.
But I went try and look for a bloody link for Smoke for Mac. Just try and wade through the corporate shitfest that the
FX Guide TV
True.
Episode on it.
Absolutely, I should have done that.
But one of my point was though that I've heard people going Smoke on Mac. I don't get it. What's the big deal?
But
my point is that there'll be people that just say Scarlet, and, you know, unless it's like $1.50, they're going to say Scarlet. I don't get it. Why don't I just shoot on a Canon? I'm not saying they should. I'm just saying I think they will.
Mm. Well, anyway, whatever numbers they think they're going to expect, there's going to be a lot more. As soon as they start a queue, it's going to go around the world twice, I think, and then go around the world twice and then end back at Red's headquarters.
Okay, so that's a positive ringing endorsement on the future sales prospect of the Red
I think so. Anyway.
We've got to go. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, really appreciate it. Over on fxguide.com, you can download this and any of the Red Centers. Again, we want to thank the Australian Society of Cinematographers and you for listening. We really do appreciate it. The emails you guys send are just absolutely the oxygen upon which this podcast exists.
That is an excellent analogy. A strange one, but an excellent analogy, Mike. Red at fxguide.com. Send us some oxygen. We appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us, red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2009, FX Guide, LLC.